the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. Our guest this week is Dr. Gary Small. We're going to talk about maintaining a healthy brain. How do you prevent Alzheimer's and dementia? And, you know, you hear about brain games. Do they really work in keeping your brain actually healthy? Now, for today's program, for the first part of it, before our guest comes on, we're going to return to a topic that remains on the radar for all retirees. Where are you going to find yields in a world that is zero bound? Of course, we're talking about interest rates. Despite the recent rate hike from the Fed, it looks less likely that the Fed is going to move forward raising rates. With all of the market turmoil lately, there has been a rush to safety, which has driven down yields despite the Fed's rate hike in December. And rates have been coming down since the beginning of the year as stocks and commodity prices have fallen last year. If you were in a bond fund, you lost money. This year, bond funds are up, but still negative over the last 12 months. So what do investors do in this kind of volatile market where just about everything fluctuates and interest rates still remain at historically low levels? What is an income investor to do in this low interest rate environment, which we've been in, by the way, since 2008? You can't live off the returns of cash, CDs, money market funds, or T-bills. What is a poor investor to do?
You know, the amazing thing, everything that we're talking about today in the financial media is about the stock market, but the bond market has been in a state of flux, John, since 2013, with wild swings in either direction. In 2013, when the taper tantrum took place, you lost double digits. In 2014, you made money if you were in a bond fund. 2015, you lost money. And this year, you're up right now, but I don't expect it to remain that way. It is one reason, John, you know, we keep emphasizing and talking on this program, we like individual bonds versus bond funds, because you have some kind of certainty and predictability. You just don't have that when you have a bond fund, and you don't have to worry about what's Janet Yellen going to do. I mean, we spent pretty much the entire year last year talking about what the Fed was going to do. Well, they finally went, and they went in December. And of course, we talked about over the weekend program in our piece that we did, a rate hike too far. And mark my words, you could see the Fed dialing back. I don't think they're going to, let's say, reverse rates, because they'd probably lose a lot of their credibility. I mean, you spent a whole year telling us you were going to raise it, and then as soon as you raise it, you know, a couple months later, you lower it. But don't be surprised. We have a credit crisis going on right now and a currency crisis that is going on as a result of the dollar. We have other issues that are going on with falling oil prices. As I talked about on the weekend program, the CRB index is the lowest it's been since 1972. So hopefully at some point you're going to see a change in the direction of the Fed. But the nice thing about owning individual bonds, if I own a 3-year bond, 4-year bond, 5-year bond, I collect my interest. When it comes due, I get my money back. I don't care what Yellen is doing. I'm getting paid.
Okay, well, you know, you've been talking about individual bonds, as you have about dividends over the last 4 or 5 years here on the show. But let's bring up an important question here. Suppose I own a bond and interest rates go up. Now, don't I lose money? I mean, won't buying a bond lose me money if that's the case?
Well, I mean, if you own a bond, let's take an example. Let's say you buy a 4% bond and matures in 5 years and interest rates go up to 5%. The value of your bond would decline depending on how far out the maturity. Obviously, the shorter the maturity, like 2 or 3 years, the less the price fluctuation. The longer the maturity, the greater the fluctuation. So if I own a 4% bond maturing in 5 years, the market value would decline slightly if interest rates go up. But here's the difference. Unlike a bond fund, my rate of return of 4% would not change. Unlike a bond fund, I would still get that every year until the bond matures. And more importantly, at the time When it does mature, I get my money back, just like, for example, if I had a maturing CD. Now, let me point out, the risk that you have with an individual bond, same risk that you have even with a bond fund, is credit risk or default risk. So if you bought a junk bond, which we wouldn't recommend doing, you run the risk that, hey, the bond could skip its interest payments, or they could actually default and go into bankruptcy. So there is a risk if you're buying high-risk bonds. But generally, if people buy quality bonds and they hold them to maturity, they get their money back, and during their holding period, they're getting the interest rate that they got when they originally bought the bond, and that never changes.
All right, let me frame this then. So what you're saying is, as long as I hold the bond until maturity, I get my check or interest every year. That doesn't change. And then at maturity, I get my bond back. So if that's the case, why don't more bond investors do that?
I mean, it obviously takes a lot more capital to buy individual bonds than a bond fund or, let's say, a bond ETF. And also, our financial industry basically sells packaged products. I mean, most people, if they have investment advisors, have mutual funds or ETFs. Very few firms buy individual bonds or individual stocks except for their wealthier clients. I mean, obviously, if you've got a good-sized portfolio, that's what happens in the larger accounts. But usually for smaller accounts, the industry basically has been geared to sell or recommend mutual funds and ETFs.
All right, so let's deal with two issues then. First of all, we have the growing turbulence that we all see in the markets right now, which surprisingly, I mean, we were talking about this during our first show of the year, but it seems to really have accelerated since the beginning of the year. And then how you find a yield in a world where rates are zero bound. So those are two issues we have to deal with.
Well, I want to address the issue from a different perspective, and it's what we do here on the program, and that's a planning perspective. Every investment portfolio should try to achieve three goals. Ensure your standard of living, assuming you're retired, against, let's say, severe short-term loss. Maintain that standard of living and improve it, hopefully, over time. Because you do know if you retire at age 65, at age 70 and 75, your expenses are going to be a lot higher than where they are when you first retired. So in order to do that, you want a diversified mix of different type of investments that can help you achieve those goals no matter what is going on in the stock and bond market, or let's say what's going on over the short term. So let's talk about what we call the safety bucket. Now, that could be cash, that could be annuities, short-term bonds. And obviously, the larger the bucket, the better off you are in being able to withstand risk elsewhere in your portfolio. So let's say, John, I have 40, 50% in bonds. I'm not as much concerned if the stock market is down 10% because I only have half my assets invested there. And chances are, as we're seeing today, if the stock market is going down, the bond market is probably going up. The problem today is that this basic concept is really not practiced. Everyone wants, I call it the pill. You'll hear when I interview Dr. Gary Small, he's written a book on getting a healthier brain. He's got a 2-week program for that. There are things you need to do in terms of your lifestyle, your diet, exercise, keeping your mind active. And when I asked him about the success of it, he says, no, most people want to take a pill. Well, it's the same thing in the investment world. Today, people want a pill, and that pill could be, oh, put all your money in a bond fund, put all your money in cash, or even worse, put all your money in gold. And that's what we've seen happen since 2009 and 2011, all in cash, all in bond funds, or even worse, all in gold.
Well, you know, we've done experts here on the program, such as Wade Fow, and they generally discuss how the early years of retirement have a higher fixed income component with a large component in equities in the latter years of retirement when medical expenses increase and then become a much larger component of the portfolio. So if I'm hearing what you're saying here about different assets in the portfolio to handle different objectives and needs, but what do investors do who need income in this low interest rate environment? Because theoretically, that's what you're going to have to do when you retire. You need a stream of income.
What I'm going to say will almost sound counterintuitive if you're listening to this. You actually look for crisis periods like we're going through now to increase your yield. Because what happens during a crisis period? Well, in 2013, we were in a crisis with the taper tantrum and bond yields went from 1.6 on a 10-year treasury to 3%. So if you were shopping for yields and laddered bonds, you actually got higher interest rates. Conversely, as we're going through now, or as we did in August, when the stock market goes down, well, dividend paying stocks, their price goes down, meaning the dividend yield goes up. So since last fall, with the anticipation of Fed rate hikes, the real opportunity in our mind is the spread between what you can get in corporate bonds and sovereigns. Now, remember, sovereign bonds or the bonds of government are probably the largest component of the bond market. But you've got artificial yields in the market because you have central banks that have been using quantitative easing. The Fed used it to bring down long-term interest rates when they printed trillions of dollars. The ECB is using it now to bring down interest rates. Folks, if you think it's bad here, one-third of the maturities in Europe are actually negative, meaning that you pay the government for them to borrow money from you. And half of the bonds, sovereign bonds in the world, yield less than 1%. So since the Fed began to tighten, this yield spread, meaning what you can get in corporate bonds and versus what you can get in sovereigns, has widened to the point that investors are now able to get 3 or 4% on short-term bonds, which, you know, we couldn't get that, John, a year ago. You were lucky if you got in the 2% range. So you can get close to 4% on bonds maturing in 2 years, even higher yields if you're willing to go out 3 or 4 years. So as a result, yields have risen on the short end of the yield curve. Now, if you're retired, I would submit to you, it's better to get 3, 4, and 5% on your money than zero on cash or money market funds. And that's really what the good news is here for income investors. So if you have a laddered bond portfolio, you can reinvest that money as it matures. So if rates, let's say, rise 2 years from now or 3 years from now, you can get a higher yield, or even better, if the stock market has corrected or we've had a bear market in stocks, as the bond matures, you can take that money, redeploy it into higher dividend paying stocks at prices that offer you a higher dividend yield, which is what we saw in 2009, 10, and 11, were three great years where, you know, it was very easy to get 4% dividend yields back then because of what happened to stock prices during the financial crisis.
Okay, well, what do you do during periods like this? I mean, if we look out there, you see all of the market turbulence. Look at what's happened just over the last couple of weeks, not to mention as we've seen over the last couple of years. And you have the perception that we've been in this perpetual crisis ever since 2009. Can't think of a year where we weren't worried about some crisis somewhere or a concatenated chain of crises that just seem to roll in one right behind the other. At least that's the emotional impact you get. So I don't imagine that as things stand now that that is really going to change very much, because you've been talking in your predictions for the last couple of years that you can make money, but there's always going to be this turbulence in where we're at.
John, you know, we're always going to have a crisis. Every year, we're going to have something that we're going to worry about. I mean, last year around this time, remember Greece, the eruptions in Greece, there was predictions the euro was going to break apart, fall apart, the world was going to end. We were worried about Greece in the first half of the year. And also remember, we got that negative print on GDP in the first quarter of last year. So just as the Fed was talking about raising interest rates, all of a sudden, we got a negative print on GDP. We had a crisis going on in Europe with the Grexit. We were worried about that. Things improved. And then China devalued as the Fed talked more and more about raising interest rates, which strengthened the dollar. And since China pegs its currency to the dollar, Chinese currency strengthened against other currencies. I mean, the dollar's up 28% against most major currencies in the world. Some have lost as much as 38%. Folks, if you want a great vacation, you might want to think of Mexico. It's 19 pesos to the dollar right now. So in this age that we live in right now, and especially I hope you got a chance last week to listen to my interview with billionaire investor Ken Fisher on his book on beating the crowd. We live in an age of a 24-hour news cycle. The media will milk the crisis for all they can get, which tends to get people to herd in one direction or another, either to panic or become euphoric, as they did in 2013.
Okay, well, I guess what this means then is there's going to be turbulence. It's like sailing a ship in turbulence. You have to sort of keep an idea of where you're coming from, where you're going to, despite all the moment-by-moment waves that you may encounter. You stay focused on your goals, and in order to do that, very much like a ship tour or airplane. You have a flight plan, say, for example. And so you have a plan, you use that plan, stay focused on the goals and on the reference points, and use the crisis periods to add to your position rather than saying, oh, woe is us. Maximize your position from this crisis period, especially if you need income from your investments to live on.
Yeah, and that's the one thing that retirees face that makes it a little bit different than those of us that are still in the workforce, because when you're in the workforce, you have your salary. But when you're retired, you know, outside Social Security, or maybe you're fortunate enough to have some kind of a pension plan, you want to have a higher return on your investments, and you have to have a plan on how to get there, and more importantly, maintain that lifestyle. I mean, think of people that been in cash since 2009 or 2011 or got out of the markets in 2000. I mean, think of all the different shifts that we've seen in the market. So if you have a plan and you're diversified, you look at these periodic corrective phases in the market as opportunities to add to holdings or pick up higher yielding investments. But I gave a case, this went back to the financial crisis in 2008. Had you walked in the office and let's say January 1st of 2008, you put 50% of your portfolio in bonds, 40% in, let's say, stocks, and then you put 10% in cash. At the bottom of the market in March of 2009, you would have been down about 7% in the worst crisis since the Great Depression. But during that period of time, in 2008, your income wouldn't have changed. It would have gone up. And in 2009, it would have gone up. And by the end of 2009, you were back to even again. So even though your stocks went down in the crisis, your bonds went up. And this is the important thing, that if you have a plan, you're diversified, you look at these periodic corrective phases in the market as opportunities to add to your holdings or pick up higher yielding investments. Now, since the Fed moved to tighten, and it began with the announcement of taper, and basically 2014 was all about reducing that, basically reducing the amount the Fed was adding or printing, it created an opportunity in the short-term corporate bond market as we have today. So if you're an investor, especially a bond investor, you can get up to 4% yields or more if you're willing to, let's say, go out a little longer. And in the stock market, you can find dividend yields that are 4, 5 in the 6% range. So if you're a patient investor and you're diversified, then these corrective phases present you more with an opportunity to increase your income than it does to panic. And it's one of the reasons why I think in this kind of market where we've had 0% interest rates for, 8 years now, that cash doesn't work in this kind of market. You want your money working for you, especially if you're retired. You can't live off what you're earning in a money market fund. It's just not going to do it. You're going to end up spending your principal. And you really don't want to do that, especially in the early years of your retirement.
Okay, so if we are looking for yields in the market that we're in, where are you going to look right now?
As we survey the market, we love the short-term and intermediate-term corporate bond market. I just think that's where the bargains are, and that's where the yields are in this kind of market. And especially, you can get these kind of yields on short-term bonds, which reduces the risk. So I like the yields because the yield curve is flattening, meaning that the long end of the bond market, that's yields of 10 years or maturities of 10, 20, and 30 years, is flattening. It's not rising as money is flooding into that market, either through quantitative easing or just simply institutions like pension funds, insurance companies that have to match their maturities to their liabilities. And so they're going in that space. So this space in the corporate bond market looks very attractive. Now, if you're a dividend investor, you can find some bargains in consumer staples that are out of favor, industrial stocks, and I'm talking about blue chips, energy, and utilities. And right now, the financial markets believe, and I think this is the wrong belief, that the Fed will continue to tighten. The dot plot is they're going to tighten 4 times this year. I just don't see that, especially with the way things are going right now. And don't be surprised if mid-year or soon they're going to be forced to reverse themselves, as the ECB did when it tightened interest rates in 2011, sent the European economy into a recession, only to reverse themselves in 2012 when Draghi took over and basically launched all kinds of programs and now QE. So if you're hunting for yields, John, this is actually a good time to start shopping.
Well, there's always the good old, I need to sleep at night, so I'm just going to hunker down in cash routine. How about that one?
There's nothing wrong with cash, and you should have some cash for emergency reasons. But the problem is cash pays zero. And if you're living off your investments and want to earn a return, you can't stay there. I'd rather be in short-term bonds where I can earn close to 4% or more than remain in cash at zero. Now, if rates rise, which they could do, I could always reinvest those bonds as they mature at higher yields. On the other hand, if the stock market corrects or we get into a bear market, I can always reinvest in dividend-paying stocks at higher dividend yields. The problem we see so frequently is investors who go to cash. The problem is they stay there. We've seen a lot of investors go into cash in 2009 at the bottom of the crisis, or in 2011 when we had another crisis and turmoil in the markets the entire year, or even worse, thinking of the worst, they put their money in gold and silver. The problem is once you go to cash, it's very hard and you very seldom get back in. I mean, think if you went to cash in 2009 and you saw the market go up 250%. Or if you went to cash in 2011 and then saw the market go up 79% in the next 3 years. And even worse, John, is the people that, you know, bought the end of the world scenario and put their money in gold and silver. And we'll be talking about a case study on today's program.
Well, one of the oldest rules in the media is if it bleeds, it leads, meaning you have to have sensationalism to get people to watch your newscast. So people buy the things the sponsors are promoting. But if there is a crisis, the media are going to run with it in this age of the 24-hour news cycle where they take a 10-minute newscast and turn it into a 24-hour day. Even though there are lots of other issues to cover, that's just the way it is because they anticipate that people are only going to watch an average of, well, 10 to 15 minutes at a pop. Even talk shows operate on that basis. So, you know, you can really fall victim to this if sensationalism grabs the headlines and then run with the herd. Or you can become a contrarian and have a plan that you know works and take advantage of the market fears and use the energy that the herd's generating by running in the wrong direction.
You know, it reminds me, and that's why if you really have the chance, I hope you got the opportunity to listen to my interview with Ken Fisher, because he was talking about the very things that we're talking about here, what the media does to investors. And it reminds me of one of the famous quotes from Ben Graham's book, The Intelligent Investor. In the short term, the market is a voting machine. In the long term, it's a weighing machine. And Graham had this character he called Mr. Market. And Mr. Market is a bipolar character. One day, he wants to sell you his shares at the cheapest price possible. The next day, he demands the biggest price possible. And that's just the nature of the market. So the more important thing that I think you want to walk away from here is some of these crisis opportunities are some of the best times to pick up income. And that is so important today if you're an income investor, because a lot of the things we used to rely on in the past, they're not there. We're not living in an age where you got 6, 7, 8% on bonds or more, or you got 5 or 6% in your money market fund or at the bank. Those days are gone. They've been gone for 8 years, and they're probably going to be gone for another decade, just like Japan has gone through zero interest rates for 2 decades. So if you're retired today, age 65, you're more likely to live 20, 25 years in retirement between you and your spouse. You cannot afford to live on 0% interest rates. So, you know, develop a plan, diversify your assets, and take advantage when these opportunities present themselves. It's a different, completely mindset. We get excited as consumers when something goes on sale at the store. When something goes on sale in the market, whether it's in the bond market or stock market, we say, no, thank you. I'd rather pay full price.
You know, coming up in just a few minutes, we'll talk to Dr. Gary Small on the subject of a healthy brain, how this plays a role in your retirement. How can you head off Alzheimer's and dementia? But first of all, we have to move to our case study, Jim. All of our case studies once a week here on Lifetime Income are based on real life case studies, but we change the names of the people to protect their privacy. Now, you were talking something about gold and silver there. Does that factor into this case?
Yeah, this is the case of Matt and Lisa Stone. They live in Texas. 61 years old, Matt is a corporate lawyer for Whole Foods, and they live with their teenage daughters in Texas. Now, Matt's wife doesn't work, and Matt plans to retire at age 66 unless his back problems force him to retire sooner. Salary, roughly about $250,000 a year, plus stock options. Now, the client has had a bad experience with investing. They experienced the bursting of the tech bubble in the early 2000s and then got hammered again for the second time in a decade in 2008. And so, as Matt was telling me, He got tired of mainstream media, and he started subscribing to various newsletters and other avenues for information. The problem is he became concerned about the U.S. and the levels of debt that we had formed under President Bush and now President Obama. And as a result, he invested very heavily into gold, and they bought some land with a house out in the country in case things deteriorated in the city, that his family would be protected. The problem was, he never diversified away and is still holding his original purchases. He also holds company stock in the form of vested options and in his 401k program. Now, this was great. Well, the company did well, but also hurt him in recent years. He has been out of the market essentially since 2008 and only at the end of 2013 got into the markets again in a trust account in his 401k program. Now, in the past, he manages investments, made decisions based on friends' recommendations, and of course, after 2008, he went on the advice of newsletters or supposed gurus, and that's a problem, because a lot of these newsletter writers, I call them like two-armed economists. They'll say, well, on one hand, if this happens, this will happen. On the other hand, if this happens, this will happen. So part of the problem was he was kind of like all in or all nothing. So this was creating quite a problem because, I mean, he was 61 and he wanted to work till age 66, at which time he would get full Social Security benefits, and his wife, Lisa, at that time would get also half of his benefits. So the idea or the plan was to work to age 66, but he also knew that he's made several mistakes in that process. For example, in personal, he had $400,000 in cash. He had $550,000 in precious metals at one time, folks. That was a $1 million precious metals portfolio. Company vested stock options were about $250,000. They were once worth about $350,000. The company 401k plan, $540,000, about 10% of it, or $60,000, was in the company's stock. Trust account had about $180,000 invested in mainly cash, gold mining stocks, and a few dividend payers, but not the kind of dividend payers that you would typically want to own in retirement. Home was valued about $400,000. They had a second home out in the country in case things fell apart. And this goes back to one of the gloom and doom letters that it was kind of basically, you know, get out of the city, stock up with food, shotgun shells, and et cetera. So they had a second home. So the net worth was roughly about $2.6 million.
You know, Jim, this isn't surprising. A lot of people were thinking in those types of terms, but that doesn't mean it was necessarily good. That's sort of the herd mentality. So what did you do in this case?
Well, the one thing we did is we recommended they sell the stock options and remove the company's stock from the 401k, since this represented almost 12% of their net worth in a single stock. So, you know, once again, he was over-concentrated. He went from diversification in the beginning of the decade, the last decade, to over-concentration, whether it was precious metals or, in this case, the company stock. The other thing we did is we recommended that he sell part of the precious metals and invest in something that was going to produce income. Matt wanted to leave at least half. We reluctantly agreed because, I mean, he still believed in it. So we took $300,000 out of metals and we put it in dividend-paying stocks. And also we created a laddered bond portfolio because his wife was more concerned about that, especially seeing what happened to him in the past and especially what happened to their precious metals. So we reduced the cash position to $100,000. And we took that and added both the stocks and bonds. We're more heavily weighted towards bonds because one of the things, as we were going through the planning process, I told them that in the early years, you really want to have more of a fixed income concentration because you don't want to start out your retirement and go through a financial crisis, which is what spooked them in 2008. And gradually over time, your equity component of your portfolio would increase as a result of dividend increases and price appreciation. The other thing we recommended and they agreed to do is sell the second home. Obviously, we're not an Armageddon scenario, and we wanted to use those proceeds once again to build that laddered bond portfolio and the dividend-paying stocks. The other thing we did is we used the proceeds from the trust account with stock options to invest. So basically what we did is we reduced the gold position, we deployed the cash, we reduced the company stock position to a smaller portion of the overall portfolio, because the goal is to continue to work for 5 more years to age 66, at which time he would receive full Social Security benefits, as would his wife, Lisa. So the idea is to keep working. So the thing that we wanted to do is his pay would be a salary and stock options. So he would continue to get stock options. So what we didn't want to do is reduce the portfolio of the company's stock to one level. So we bring it more in line with the portfolio. And then as stock options matured and invested, that percentage would rise again. So we would be selling off those options, keeping the company stock to no more than 5% of the portfolio.
Obviously, more important to have a plan here than to do any herd running, because, well, herds tend to take you in a given direction. Usually what you do, Jim, is when you start out doing something, you just begin looking around and asking, and after a while, you'll be able to put together a plan if you get the right advice, but you have to do a little grease work there, so to speak. So anyway, that was our real life case study. Coming up next here, Dr. Gary Small, looking forward to this interview. Healthy brain, how do you preserve it all the way into retirement years? Preventing Alzheimer's and dementia. And you know, they talk about brain games, things that you need to do to keep your brain supported. And does that actually play a role in preventing the onset of some really bad neurological diseases? We'll hear all of that coming up next as Lifetime Income continues at FinancialSense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Well, the good news is Americans are living longer. The bad news, as we age, we're more susceptible to some debilitating diseases such as dementia and Alzheimer's. Joining me on the program is Dr. Gary Small. He's professor of psychiatry and biobehavioral sciences at the Parlow Solomon Professor on Aging at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. He's also author of a new book called 2 Weeks to a Younger Brain. Doctor, over the last couple of years, you've seen a lot of software programs that have come out, cognitive training software, brain games. Let's talk about them. Are they really effective in arresting or enhancing the brain's functionality? I know there have been a number of tests, a number of claims made in advertising. I'd like to get your view on their effectiveness.
Some of the games are effective, and it depends how an individual uses them, whether they overuse them or underuse them, and what they're trying to train their brains to do. We did a study a number of years ago where we found that just searching online can activate our neural circuits, and it can be done very quickly. We can train an older person to search online for the first time, and we see increased activity in the frontal lobe. Now, whether that leads to improvement in everyday memory abilities, in thinking capacity, and other mental skills is not certain.
I know there's been studies done that if we do things that challenge our brain, for example, my wife's grandmother lived into her late 90s, was sharp as a tack. She was a bridge master, but things like playing bridge, learning a foreign language, learning to dance, doing something different, training our minds to do something that we haven't done before, is that more effective than, let's say, sitting in front of a computer playing some games?
That depends. We always say train but don't strain your brain. So you want to engage in mental activities that are fun and challenging, but not too challenging, because that will be stressful and the person will get bored, as they will if the game is too easy. There are computer games and apps and programs that have been designed to train specific mental skills. And they've been tested in scientific settings to show that they do actually work. So, for example, a company I consulted with a number of years ago, Dacom Brain Fitness, they developed some games And one of the psychologists at UCLA did a study and showed that when people played these games for maybe 20 minutes a day for a few months, there was significant improvement in everyday memory skills. And there are other examples of games that have been tested. Scientists at the University of California in San Francisco have studied a game called NeuroRacer that involves keeping a race car on a windy road while informative and uninformative road signs pop up. So it trains multitasking skills. And that group has shown that after playing for a few weeks or so, that a 75-year-old can multitask at the same level as an untrained 20-year-old.
Now, are these games out there? I mean, in the medical profession, there's always ratings. Is there any kind of rating system in terms of these games out there? Because there are a number of sites out there that make a lot of claims as to the effectiveness of their software program. But is there anything that you have looked at UCLA or have rated games or programs for their effectiveness?
To my knowledge, there's not a scientific group that has rated these games. I mean, if you're looking at an app and you're going to download that on your phone, of course you're going to see customer ratings and how much people like the games, how much fun they are. So I think for this kind of approach to be successful, it has to be engaging, it has to be fun, so people come back for more. If there's a social component to it, it tends to be stickier, so to speak. So if you look at a game like Words with Friends, a lot of people do that because it's fun. It's like a Scrabble type of game. Now, whether that actually improves your vocabulary or improves your everyday memory, I don't know that it does. But there are other interesting games that do seem to have an impact. There's been a lot of research looking at games that are similar to the old game of concentration. There's actually a television show that some of us baby boomers may remember. And you can play the game even with a deck of cards where you try to remember the placement of certain cards after you turn them over. Well, if you play this kind of game and it's done in a certain way, you can actually improve what's called working memory. Now, working memory is very short-term memory, the kind of memory we use to hold information in mind long enough to use it. So if you call directory assistance, you get a phone number, and you dial that number, that's working memory. You're not going to remember that number 10 minutes from then. But it turns out if you improve your working memory, it actually transfers to your ability to think and reason, actually a form of IQ called fluid intelligence. So it is possible to build these different mental skills by playing these various games.
Now, I know you've written a number of books about dementia and Alzheimer's, and you've come to the conclusion, I think, that much of this, close to 75% of this, is lifestyle versus, let's say, just pure genetics. Can you define that for our listeners? When you talk about lifestyle, does that mean the way we live, the stress in our lives, whether we exercise, whether we diet, whether we do things that keep our brains active, social networks? Define lifestyle and what makes it effective in perhaps postponing or resting or preventing dementia and Alzheimer's.
So the MacArthur study of successful aging defined success as we age as mental and physical success. And the conclusion from that study was what you alluded to, that non-genetic factors, and much of this does have to do with lifestyle, these factors are more important in determining how long and how well we live. And I tend to cluster these kind of lifestyle strategies into several groups. Mental stimulation, somewhat of what we've been talking about so far. Physical exercise, stress management and mindfulness is another area. Diet, and an area that overlaps with some of these would be social engagement. And finally, healthcare and making wise decisions about different choices. For example, whether to smoke or not, whether to wear a helmet, if you ride a bicycle. And the accumulating data shows how important these factors are. So if we take physical exercise, I would probably rank that as one of the most important because we have the best science on it. And studies show that if you get your heart to pump oxygen and nutrients to your brain will be bigger, it will function better, and it will delay the onset of Alzheimer's symptoms. It also gets your body to produce endorphins, which improves your mood, and a chemical called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF, which actually gets your brain cells to sprout branches and communicate more effectively. When we look at diet, the number one issue is overweight and obesity, which is an epidemic around the world. If you're overweight, it doubles your risk for Alzheimer's disease. If you're obese, that quadruples the risk. But the good news is, when people lose weight, their memory rapidly improves. And of course, the kinds of foods we ingest are important. Most people don't get enough omega-3 fats from fish and nuts and flaxseed. They don't get enough fruits and vegetables that are antioxidant and protect the brain from oxidative stress that occurs with age. And there's too much ingestion of processed foods and refined sugars that are not good for your body and not good for your brain. And then stress management is critically important. We know that chronic stress actually shrinks the memory centers of the brain. And whether it's meditation or yoga or Tai Chi, these approaches can improve cognitive abilities, mood, and even increase life expectancy.
So, doctor, would you say it's just not one thing that you do that makes up this lifestyle? It's usually a combination, as you just went through there. You talked about, you know, obviously eliminating stress, exercise, getting oxygen to the brain, and also diet. Are there particular foods? I mean, you see these commercials on television talking about supplements that are great for the brain or enhance the brain's function. Any truth to that? Or are there foods out there that we can eat that have been proven to be very beneficial to brain health?
So there is some emerging research in the area of supplements, and some supplements have shown benefits in the short term. But a lot of what's sold does not have evidence from double-blind placebo-controlled studies. Now, these are studies where you take a group of people who actually get the supplement or nutrient and a group that gets a placebo, an ineffective one, and neither the investigators nor the volunteers know who's getting what. And that's the only way you can really tell if the stuff works. So there's more research going on in that area, and I'm cautiously optimistic that we're going to get more data on that. And I like to recommend that people try to get their nutrients from their diet. And it's certainly possible to do that. And in my books, you mentioned the latest 2 weeks to a younger brain, we go into some detail on how each of us can do that, to eat a diet that is both nutritious and delicious.
Now, there's all kinds of diets out there. There's the Mediterranean diet, there's vegetarian, there's vegans, there's the paleo diet. Have you found any one of those kind of diets in particular to be most beneficial?
The Mediterranean-style diet has probably the most evidence that it's brain-protective. Some of these others, like the paleo and some others that you mentioned, I think there's less evidence. It may help people in general. Vegetarians tend to be more fastidious about their health, and they tend to do well. But their challenge, of course, is to make sure they get enough protein. Because as we age, there's a problem called sarcopenia, where older people lose their muscle mass. And that is not a good health situation to be involved in.
I know that there have been a number of studies in terms of health as we age. For example, they recommend as people age, weightlifting to strengthen the bones, cardio. Are there particular exercises? I mean, or it can be just as simple as going for a half an hour or an hour walk each day. Is something as simple as that, or is it, let's say, require a little bit more complexity, a combination of maybe not only cardio, but also weightlifting and things like yoga or Tai Chi to maintain flexibility and de-stress?
I think the important consideration is what works for the individual so they keep coming back. Weekend warriors are not going to fare well. They're more likely to injure themselves. They're not going to get the steady workout. And I often recommend that people who are starting just get a 15-minute brisk walk every day. Pick a time. It could be after dinner. It can be in the morning. And that becomes a routine. And then you can build from there in terms of your cardiovascular fitness. In addition to that, it's very important to get some strength training. The studies have shown that weightlifting or TheraBand-type exercises that increase your muscle strength provide an additional cognitive benefit. And I think the final issue that particularly older people need to keep in mind is balance. A lot of older people fall and injure themselves, and so some kind of balance training, I think, is very important.
Now, you've done a number of studies, and in your book, you have a chapter on there. It's a program, a two-week program to a younger brain. Let's talk a little bit about that, because it seems to incorporate many of the things that we've been talking about, from diet to exercise, de-stressing, and a number of things, but it's not very difficult. Let's talk about that for a moment and how practical it can be to put into effect.
The idea of the two-week program is to get people started, is to take these different approaches and exercises to manage stress better, to get some daily cardiovascular exercise, to plan out a reasonable diet. All that is incorporated into the two-week program so people begin to form healthy lifestyle habits. I see a lot of people in my practice, and I take a holistic approach where I deal with the medical issues, but also the lifestyle issues. And often when I get to the lifestyle issues and I recommend a certain diet or I recommend exercise, the reaction is, "Doc, don't you have a pill?" So I think it's hard for people to change their behavior. And this is a way to make it easy, to show them that it's fun. And once they get started, then it becomes addictive. Then they get into the habit of it. And that's what they need. 2 weeks is not going to make your brain younger if you stop after 2 weeks. But it's just enough time to begin to form those healthy brain habits.
Speaking of pills, doctor, what advances are being made? We've seen advances made on heart disease. We've seen advances in cancer treatments. What about advances in dementia and Alzheimer's in terms of drug therapies? What is going on in that realm that can improve or at least arrest the disease or delay it?
There are advances, but it's been slower than many of us would like. There's been a lot of drug development aimed at clearing out the abnormal amyloid plaque deposits that accumulate in the memory and thinking centers of the brain. And that approach has not been successful over the last few decades. But there are studies trying to develop medicines that cut down on inflammation in the brain. We think that's a very important problem in the brain. And even beyond the drug development phase, there's a whole area of what's called neuromodulation, using electrical signals, magnets, ultrasound waves to activate or deactivate groups of neurons in the brain to help improve brain health and memory. And in all these areas, our research group is very interested and we're pursuing different studies.
I want to come back to brain games because you have a whole chapter in that. And that may be easier for some people to do because most adults today are computer savvy. We have tablets or even our cell phones or computers today. Let's talk about some of those brain games. In your book, you have a listing of several sites or computer sites that you can go to. Are there any that you have found in your studies to be much more effective in terms of results?
Well, that's a tough question to answer because saying one is more effective really means that you've done a head-to-head comparison. So you've taken brain game A and compared it to brain game B and shown one is better than the other. And generally, studies have not been conducted in that way. Now, there have been some studies that have looked at specific effects of these games. And I mentioned one that I'm familiar with, the Dacom Brain Fitness, where they did show improvement in memory after 2 months and even greater improvement after 6 months. There's the game NeuroRacer that seems to improve multitasking skills. There's a game that I didn't mention that is called IQ Boost. It's an app, and it has a form of this concentration game that helps people with short-term memory or working memory. And then there's a lot of others out there. I mean, I just haven't vetted them and looked at them. I mean, I would guess that some of them may be effective, and a lot of them are not that effective. But what's important, I think, for the consumer is to play games that are fun. That's going to engage your mind, and if you can keep challenging yourself, it's probably going to be a fun mental activity, even if we don't have the scientific proof that it's going to improve your memory.
And doctor, when you take a look at all of this, let's talk, number one, about prevention. And secondly, what if you do have, or let's say between spouses, you notice that one spouse has the beginning signs of dementia. What are steps that can be taken? In other words, are there things that you can do to maybe either reverse the process or arrest it?
So in the area of prevention, we're actually launching a new study at UCLA, the UCLA Alzheimer's Prevention Project, where we've developed a curriculum that trains people to pretty much do what I've written out in the book, In 2 Weeks to a Younger Brain. And the system to do that, and we're going to be testing that systematically in people who are at risk for Alzheimer's disease. And there are a lot of reasons people are at risk. It's their age, could be they have diabetes, or they have high blood pressure, or some other factor like obesity or overweight. So I'm convinced that these approaches will help prevent in the sense of delaying onset of symptoms. It's not going to cure the problem, but it could give you a few years of being symptom-free, which can be very meaningful in people's lives. So I think that's really the way to go, particularly if you have a risk factor. You need to get healthy, and it's never too early and never too late to live a healthy brain lifestyle. Now, if somebody is in the beginning phases of dementia kinds of symptoms, that is where their memory and other cognitive skills are starting to interfere with your everyday life, it's very important to see a doctor to get a medical evaluation. Because even though we don't have drugs that will cure the disease, there are medicines that can improve symptoms and keep people functioning at a higher level longer.
And doctor, as we close, there's another study that comes in and talks about as we age, our internal clocks begin to change and a new timekeeper sort of kicks in. We heard about older people that need less sleep. They go to bed earlier. They wake up earlier. And, you know, you see this even in restaurants cater to early dining. Let's talk about that. And is this harmful? Is there anything that can be done about it? Or is it just part of the natural process of getting older and aging?
Sleep patterns change as we age. As we get older, we tend not to need as much sleep. We have lighter sleep. And I think it's something that is an issue because a lot of older people do have sleep problems. As far as eating early, that depends on the individual. But I see some older people who develop cognitive symptoms that they start sleeping later and later during the day. And I think part of it is that it's stressful for them to engage socially during the day. And this is a way for them to sort of fade away from their social interactions. And I don't think that's good. It's very important to maintain social contacts. So I think we need to deal with sleep in a reasonable way and try to help people engage during the day.
Well, listen, doctor, I want to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. The name of your book, 2 Weeks to a Younger Brain, by Dr. Gary Small. Doctor, I want to thank you for joining us on the program. All the best to you, sir.
Thank you. I appreciate your interest.
Interesting interview with Dr. Gary Small, because I always wonder about that. If you use your brain a lot, and I think people just don't nowadays, you know, but I've seen people that always do crossword puzzles. My mother did that for years and years and years, worked crossword puzzles from the New York Times and elsewhere as to whether or not it keeps your brain healthy. So anyway.
Yeah, they say that too. People that play bridge. I mean, Warren Buffett, a good example. Warren is, 85? I remember my mother-in-law played bridge until she passed away. And my wife's grandmother was a bridge master in her late 90s. Sharp as a tack, too. So exercising that brain, whether it's learning something new, dancing, a foreign language, painting, doing something that is different, reading, taking a class, going to college, you know, educating yourself. There's all kinds of things that you can do to keep a healthy brain. Most important thing, I think I've read all three of Dr. Small's books, is that so much of dementia and Alzheimer's is a reflection 75% of lifestyle rather than it is DNA. So, interesting book. Recommend if you have a chance, pick it up. Some great stuff in there, and especially his two-week program to get back to a healthy brain. Well, we've run out of time. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.